2006 Sunstone Symposium Arizona presents Session 14, Biographers and the Mormon Prophet Puzzle, 1974 to 2004, a plenary address by D. Michael Quinn.
University of Illinois at Chicago, and Jan Shipps from Indiana University, Purdue University at Indianapolis, and finally Gordon Wood from Brown University. Because of its almost official format, Swinton's American Prophet is extraordinary for what it includes, especially very non-devotional observations from some 19th century contemporaries and from these 20th century scholars. Beginning with the martyrdom as its first chapter, the book quotes those who publicly cheered the death of a man they called, quote, blasphemous wretch and money digger. Do I personally believe, says Professor Rimini in a sidebar? No, he may have believed that he did. But whether he saw God in Jesus, I have no evidence for that, unquote. It's a very American tradition and a very American book, observes in this official, semi-official publication, observes Professor Hughes, who is subtly summarizing the view of naturalistic interpreters of the Book of Mormon. Another quote, I would as soon compare a bat to the American eagle, said Reverend Alexander Campbell of the 1830 translation in relation to the Bible. Professor Hatch states, quote, I would not paint Joseph Smith in pastel colors. He was a radical preacher of extreme ideas, very powerful ideas, which had tremendous appeal, particularly for those who were on the margins of society. But they were extreme ideas, unquote. In 1830, dissenter Ezra Booth publicly questions Smith's prudence and stability. This ends up in that same Desert Book publication as a quote. Professor Marty asserts, quote, had I been on the same hill, I wouldn't have seen what he saw, unquote. In addition, a woman who had left the ranks of the church in Nauvoo charged, as quoted by this Desert Book publication, quote, one needs a throat like an open sepulcher to swallow down all that is taught here, unquote. In 1844, ex-counselor William Law denounced Smith as, quote, one of the blackest and basest scoundrels that has appeared upon the stage of human existence, unquote. All of this being published by the official publication arm of the LDS Church, Desert Book through its subsidiary. The semi-official biography also affirms Smith's search for Spanish treasure. Also, it says that Mormons brought persecution on themselves in Missouri because, quote, they embodied a threat to the existing economic, social, and political forces, unquote. Through buying through one another, through voting together as a bloc, and for not in integrating into the larger community, unquote. Again, quote, the Nauvoo Legion with 2,000 mounted troops provided a sense of security to LDS citizens, but it was viewed as a threat by the rest of Illinois, unquote. In addition, the publication by Desert Book specifies that Joseph Smith in Nauvoo was mayor, lieutenant general of the Nauvoo Legion, a trustee for the University of Nauvoo, a subscriber to the Nauvoo Agriculture and Mine and Manufacturing Association, publisher of the semi-monthly newspaper Times and Seasons. He was also the Chief Justice and in 1844 announced his candidacy for the presidency of the United States, unquote. Therefore, quote, Nauvoo also drew resistance from its neighbors over its curious role as almost a city-state, which newspapers called a great military despotism. Also, they dismissed Mayor Smith as, quote, a power broker. The biography also refers to, quote, the Masonic Lodge, of which Joseph was a member. In addition, quote, Joseph introduced a few trusted friends to the added concept of a plurality of wives as practiced by Abraham and ancient prophets. And then this semi-official book published by a subsidiary of Deseret Book spends a full page discussing polygamy. Among the things the semi-official biography comes close to revealing, but not quite, is Joseph Knight's non-traditional accounts of Moroni's instruction to Joseph Smith from 1823 to the quoted statements in 1826. It also doesn't quite report the full story behind treasure seekers who tried to make the case that they had rights to the Book of Mormon, which implies but doesn't really unpack the idea that Smith had previously worked with these treasure seekers in the treasure quest. It quotes from the LDS messenger and advocate about his being tried as a disorderly person without explaining that this applies to his 1826 court appearance for using the seer stone to help Stoll's treasure digging. Quote, the doctrines Joseph Smith preached were revolutionary for the day. True. But the book mutes to near unrecognizability Smith's teachings that God was once human and that humans can become gods, which are reduced to a cryptic phrase that only the well-informed would understand. Quote, Joseph addressed the character of God, the origin and destiny of man, unquote. Furthermore, some topics are completely missing. The Dianites are absent from the description of the 1838 Mormon War in Missouri. In the discussion of Smith's 1844 arrest for destroying the anti-Mormon newspaper in Nauvoo, there was no mention that he left the city and intended to escape his enemies. Published in 2002 by Lipper Viking Press as a part of the Penguin series of short biographies was Robert V. Remini's Joseph Smith. And this is remarkable because this put Joseph Smith in the class of the other very limited series of short biographies published by Penguin Books, which is a British publishing house. This puts him in rank with Martin Luther, in rank with Martin Luther. I'm trying to remember now. Martin Luther is the only religious leader I remember him the series discussing. But the series, by including him, raises his national reputation to a high degree. It was only 190 pages long without footnotes, and it's really quite a remarkable achievement. An award-winning biographer, Remini is one of the foremost scholars of U.S. history in the early decades of the 19th century. His book specifically avoids naturalistic assumptions. Quote, after considerable thought, I decided to present his religious experiences just as he described them in his writings and let readers decide for themselves to what extent they would give credence to them, unquote. His preface ends, Joseph Jr. deserves a respectful hearing, unquote. He gives primary attention to narratives by the faithful, with only occasional nods towards skeptical perspectives. Controversial topics like the treasure quest, apostasies, financial failures, violence, plural marriage, and theocracy emerge without sensationalism. While some might wince at this realistic assessment of Smith's youth, quote, after all, he was a teenager, and like all his peers, he had to contend with raging hormones and the torment of puberty, unquote, they can take comfort in such positive assessments as Remini writing, quote, Joseph himself was a man of compelling charisma, charm, and persuasiveness, a man absolutely convinced that his religious authority came directly from God, unquote. Written for general readers in an engaging style, Remini, better than any other biography to date, deftly interweaves the Mormon experience with the rambunctious national culture. I'm speaking of books published up to 1995, not in 1995. Fair to the faith, this is an ideal starting point, and I still say this, for non-members who are interested in Joseph Smith and Mormon origins, but not enough to want footnotes or a long book. If you want a non-Mormon to appreciate Joseph Smith, don't have them read Richard Bushman's long book or the book by, which I long recommended, the book by Donna Hill. Those are too long for a non-Mormon. Have them read Remini, which is 190 pages, no footnotes, and a really wonderfully expressed and written introduction to Joseph Smith. Okay, next book. Matthew B. Brown's Joseph Smith, The Man, The Mission, The Message was published by Covenant Communications in 2004, obviously intended for a believing audience of Mormons. Because I usually examine bibliography and source notes first, I was surprised that he omits any citation to the favorable biographies by Donna Hill in 1977 and Richard Bushman in 1984. Then I was puzzled to find citation to hostile 19th century books by a variety of authors. Aimed at devout Mormon readers, the main text is a very interesting mix of candor and concealment. Quoting contemporary sources, Brown gives unflattering descriptions of the prophet's, quote, prominent nose, quote, massive mouth, quote, whistling speech, quote, stooped shoulders, quote, quite small hands, quote, massive feet, limping walk, and, quote, corpulency, plus observing that his speech was, quote, awkward, stuttering, and stammering, unquote. In a chapter about the prophet's character, the first heading is, in large capital letters, imperfect, with introductory statement that Smith was, quote, an admirable man who was nevertheless thoroughly human, unquote. Among Smith's admirable qualities were that he, quote, assisted in the care of his children, unquote, did housework, expressed humility, and had family prayers three times daily. The chapter also gives space to the occasion when the prophet kicked Josiah Butterfield, actually a General Authority 70, in the seat of the pants and threw him out of the house. After a quote that Smith was a, quote, tender and affectionate husband, the same page describes how he insisted on wrestling a man who was 70 pounds lighter than himself and broke the man's leg by accident. So you see a complex, contradictory image of Joseph Smith in this devotional biography. Rather than trying to diminish Smith's heterodoxy, Brown refers to his teachings that God was once a human being and that humans can become gods. Among his biography's surprising disclosures is that, quote, Joseph Smith was ordained a king of the Council of 50, which he had organized for a theocratic government, and that he was also a candidate for the U.S. presidency. With that kind of candor, it is obvious what the author editors regarded as forbidden topics. There is no mention of young Joseph's work as a treasure seer, nor of the Danites, nor of his polygamous wives. However, perhaps slyly, Brown quotes three of them, Eliza R. Snow, Emily Partridge Young, and Zina Huntington Jacobs Young. The large format books by Swinton and Brown provide an important and interesting context for Joseph Smith's Praise to the Man, published by Millennial Press, also in 2004. Its textual author is Susan Easton Black, a professor of church history and doctrine at Brigham Young University. Even more than Brown's source gaps, Professor Black's omission of sources is stunning. With citations to more than 20 authors publishing after 1930, there is no reference to Hill, Bushman, or Remini, although she cites five works that can be considered biographical of Joseph Smith, a very slender book by Edwin F. Perry in 1934, one each by fellow BYU religion professors Hiram L. Andrus and Ivan J. Barrett, who were appointed a generation earlier than her own faculty appointment, plus her own biographical collections of 1993 and 1998. Truly mystifying in a book aimed at devout Mormon believers, there is no acknowledgement of a devotional biography by George Q. Cannon, nor by Apostle Widsoe, nor by John Henry Evans. To the rationalization that a three-page section of endnotes must conserve space and cannot list everything, I agree. However, there was sufficient room for Millennial Press to place in the middle of Black's endnotes a 3-by-4-inch photograph of, quote, rake from Joseph Smith Sr. barn in Palmyra, unquote. On a scale of priorities, I would say that a farm implement is less important in the source notes of a devotional book than citing favorable biographies published in recent years by scholars, plus older faith-promoting biographies by a counselor in the First Presidency, Cannon in 1888, and a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, Widsoe, in 1951. Evans is at least worth noting as the author of the first laudatory Mormon biography to be issued by a major New York publishing house. 1933. Also absent from Swinton, Evans is in Brown's selected bibliography. Topics submitted by Professor Black far exceed the protectiveness of the semi-official biography in 1999 and Brown's devotional work published the same year as hers. Absent are even the slightest allusions to Smith's treasure quest, the anti-Mormon mobbings in Independence, Missouri during 1833, Smith's leading a retributive military expedition, Zion's Camp, to that place from Ohio in 1834, his publication of the Doctrine and Covenants in 1835, the Missouri Danites of internal LDS intimidation and external defense in 1838, the fact that Mormons engaged in armed warfare that year and led by Apostles David W. Patton and Parley P. Pratt killed several members of the Missouri militia. In some ways, those are controversial, and one could understand Professor Black admitting them. But there is no mention of baptism for the dead, the endowment ceremony, the sealing of marriages for time and eternity, the Theocratic Council of 50, Joseph Smith as city mayor and U.S. presidential candidate, nor that he defended himself against the Carthage mobbers by firing a six-shot revolver at them. However, she does admit, quote, "the prophet made an attempt to escape the martyr's fate," unquote. Moreover, Professor Black accompanies her silence about plural marriage with a nod and a wink to knowing readers. The nod goes to Joseph Smith's wives with prominent sidebar quotes, Zina Jacobs and Eliza R. Snow. The wink is reserved for this quote from Mary Elizabeth Rollins, currently living with her husband, Adam Leitner, when she became the prophet's polyandrous wife. Quote, "I could not take my eyes off him," unquote. Even more directly, Black gives a bibliographical reference for another topic her book omits, the Dianites. Twice, her endnotes cite quotes from the 1838 Mormon War in Missouri. Stephen Lee Lesueur's scholarly study, published by University Press, gives details of the Danite Band and the separate incidents of endorsement or participation by every then-current member of the LDS presidency in the Danite Band. She could have quoted the 19th-century sources directly because they didn't have anything to do with the Danites. Or she could have noted their quotes from less controversial publications of recent date. Instead, she introduces readers to a scholarly book that emphasizes the topic that was too controversial for her to utter, but too important to conceal completely. Her narrative also has faint traces of another topic and source she omits. Her awareness of Moraine's Freudian view of Smith's castration anxiety seems evident in the way she alters well-known aspects of two relevant incidents from Smith's own published history and his mother's biography. To keep the surgeon's amputation knife as far as possible from the 7-year-old's groin, she claims the doctors, quote, suggested amputating the boy's foot, unquote, rather than his leg. Not coincidentally, I'm sure, she fails to mention that the Ohio mob in 1832 brought along a doctor to castrate Smith before they tarred and feathered him, an outcome avoided only by the physician's last-minute change of heart. Today, more than 31 years after Jan Shipps published her challenge, what are the ramifications of 7 biographies published during the past 7 years? I think there has been progress toward integrating the two Josephs, particularly on the devotional side, as indicated by Swinton's semi-official 1999 biography and Brown's candidly devotional biography in 2004. But even here, contradictory currents persist. The semi-official biography is willing to discuss topics that the privately published biography withholds from the devout, and vice versa. Moreover, the BYU religion professor's biography is notably less willing than the LDS headquarters-approved book 5 years earlier to report secondary scholarship and to acknowledge controversies in Smith's life. This parallels the Roman Catholic Church's experience, in which religion professors of its colleges and universities have often been more conservative than the Pope, and more hesitant than faithful Catholic academics outside Vatican-controlled institutions. The devotional LDS press is still not fully comfortable with the candor Hill demonstrated in 1977 and Bushman in 1984. But historiographic change is discernible at LDS headquarters, in the Mormon culture region, and in BYU's College of Religious Education. On the scholarly, non-devotional side, an odd divergence has occurred. Scholars without Mormon background, like Remini, are writing and talking about Smith in the way Shipps recommended concerning the prophet-fraud dichotomy. Others, often of restoration background, like Moraine and Vogel, are finding sophisticated ways to present him as a sympathetic fraud. Still others, like Anderson, also of Mormon background, present Smith as a vicious fraud unworthy of devotion, respect, or even sympathy. So the picture is mixed. Nevertheless, I think that aside from polemical works, pro and con, one's religious affiliation and belief are becoming irrelevant to the question of how scholars and even popular authors will approach Joseph Smith and early Mormon history in future biographies, large and small. And to those biographers in waiting, I revise a challenge I published 12 years ago. Write comprehensively and sympathetically about a man who was a youthful mystic, a treasure seeker, a visionary who spoke modern revelations and communicated ancient ones anew, a loving husband who deceived his wife regarding polygamous proposals, marriages, and cohabitations, a man for whom friendship and loyalty meant everything, but who provoked disaffection by testing the loyalty of his devoted associates, an anti-Mason who became a master Mason, a church president who physically assaulted both Mormons and non-Mormons for insulting him, a devoted father who loved to care for his own children and those of others, a temperance leader and social drinker, a Bible revisionist and esoteric philosopher, a pacifist and commander-in-chief, a student of Hebrew and Egyptology, an indigent and bank president, a friend of American Indians and occupier of lands he regarded as rightfully theirs, a jail escapee, a healer, a city planner and land speculator, a mayor, a judge, and fugitive from justice, an absolute heterosexual who enjoyed snuggling in bed with male friends, a guarantor of religious freedom, but limiter of freedom of speech and press, a preacher and street wrestler, a polygamist and advocate of women's rights, a husband of other men's wives, a declared bankrupt who became the trustee in trust of church finances, a political horse trader and U.S. presidential candidate, an abolitionist who authorized the ordination of already free African Americans but respected the rights of slave owners, a theocratic king, an insider to riot, an unwilling martyr. We have such a man in Brother Joseph. Give us biographies to match him. Thank you.
So I'm sure some of you will have questions for Michael Quinn. So please begin, and we have about 15 minutes.
You didn't address Bushman's most recent work. I assume you have opinions about it.
Yes, I have read it, but I didn't want to be here hours and hours, longer than your patience would allow. Bushman's biography is really quite a watershed, and I think that he certainly does what Jan Shipps recommended. He presents the complexities of Joseph Smith. He shows him as a very flawed human, but as a very flawed prophet. And Bushman is unapologetic about his own belief in Joseph Smith as a prophet. But if I were to quote zinger after zinger that Bushman puts in his book, and read those off, many of you would be convinced I'm quoting from an anti-Mormon book. He is very blunt. Now, there are other times when he allows the readers to connect the dots. But in a remarkable number of times, dozens of times, he throws in these zingers, which are truly extraordinary. And I think that particularly since Bushman's book has been published by the same publisher who published Von Brody's book in 1945, that it is possible, but one will remain to be seen, but it is possible that Bushman's biography will finally replace Von Brody's for those non-Mormons who want to read a carefully written, incisive biography of the Mormon prophet. But the fact that Bushman, in the preface, very openly expresses his view as a believer may make it impossible for Brody to be replaced. But I think in terms of the scope of his presentation, that's a possibility. And I further deponent knoweth not or saith not at this time.
Do you have an emotional favorite, not necessarily one that gives you a sense of who he was as a complex individual, but a biography that gave you a sense of who he was on a gut or emotional level? Does that make any sense?
Yes.
Yeah, thanks.
Even though I don't agree with the basic premise, and it's an interesting way to introduce my acceptance or comment about Moraine's book, I don't see Joseph Smith in the same way Moraine sees him. However, I must admit that Moraine's compassion was overwhelming. And as I read through his emphasis on this incident, and I have to say it from my point of view too. I grew up, I had surgeries after surgeries from the age of 18 months onward. I felt like I was raised by physicians and nurses. And so I understand what childhood trauma is about, because I experienced it. But I somehow distanced even my own experience from Joseph Smith's. And it wasn't until I read Moraine's book, which is written from the point of view of a surgeon who has operated primarily on pediatric cases, and his compassion, that I fully got it. And I think this is extraordinary in terms of my own background. And I there were tears in my eyes, and sometimes more than just in my eyes, as I read Moraine's book. But I must say that I don't agree with his view of the Book of Mormon as a subconscious working out, or a self-deluded working out of the trauma. He sees it as a... he doesn't see it really as a work of fiction. He sees it as a work of self-therapy. I don't agree with that. But in terms of your question about compassion, emotional gripping, I didn't find Bushman's book as emotionally gripping for me as Moraine's. Yes?
Wait. My question is this, and I'm not sure if you can answer it.
My question is this. I'm not sure exactly if it makes a very good question, but it came to my mind that as you're going through this process of people writing various biographies, they're writing at different times in the history of the church, even in this short period you covered. And I'm just wondering if you could comment, maybe there's nothing to comment on, but if you could comment on the struggle of the historian to produce his work or her work during a climate, intellectual or political or, I don't know, ideological climate that's going on. I know that the historian has to try to recognize biases, but there are these pressures that exist at the time the person is writing, and how that climate affects the ultimate product that the historian produces.
Well, Owen writes in a vacuum. No historian is, as I said when I was commenting on Vogel's comment about bias, no one is separate from their own personal biases, and their biases include not only their belief systems, but their affiliations with various organizations, whether it's political, religious, or otherwise. And so whether we're looking at a non-Mormon scholar like Remini, or we're looking at former Mormon believers who no longer believe, like Anderson or Vogel, we're influenced, or whether we're looking at Bushman, who is an ardent believer. Despite all efforts to do our best professionally, we are inevitably influenced by our belief systems, our experiences, and part of the experience is what the transitions the LDS Church has been going through, even in the short period of time that I discussed, although I really was looking at basically a 30-year period of time, and in that period, huge changes. The last 7 years, not quite so many changes, but in some ways the last 7 years have been a culmination of changes that were beginning 30 years ago. It's inevitable that the willingness to be open, the willingness or the unwillingness to be open, are affected by those institutional concerns on the part of Mormon believers, and also on a certain anger that particularly comes across in Anderson. The anger is on almost every page. And part of that is affected by a response to the institutional church. So it's impossible to totally eliminate from our perception, our presentation, a bias. I mean, we see the world through lenses. Bias isn't something that you can just throw away. I mean, it's like a permanent set of dark glasses or a permanent set of colored lenses. It affects how we see everything, our biases, and our biases are multiple. So it's like a kaleidoscope of lenses, colored lenses that affect how we see the world. But if we are thoughtful and careful, and scholars as historians are trained to do this, to be aware of our own biases and to be so much aware of them that we try to compensate for them. And that's the best you can ask, is an effort to compensate for those biases by acknowledging them, for one thing, and by bringing in balance. And Bushman certainly does that. He does it in terms of the large biographies that have been done in the last 10 years, Bushman does it better than anyone else. Remini, I would say, does it too, but his is such a short biography. And if we compare them to long biographies where the biographer has the time, the space to develop ideas and counter ideas, I don't think anyone has presented the contraries of Joseph Smith's life as well as the contraries of interpretations of his life better than Bushman's most recent biography, Rough Stone Rolling. Yes.
I realize this may be apples and oranges, but do you at any point in your research or in your studies consider any of the writings of the Tanners?
Well, the Tanners are not known for being wildly interpretive. They substitute bold lettering and underlining for interpretation. So I think it's not even apples and oranges. It's something far different from that. You said onions? Oh well, okay, all right, maybe. Although some people like the mixture of apples and onions, so. But The Tanners, I have said this in print. I have not just said it privately. And the Tanners, in the nearly 50 years that they've been doing this now, well, 40 years. 40 years they've been doing this. I was overstating that. They started about 1961. In the 40 years they've been doing this, they have really made a contribution to Mormon historiography, not through their interpretations, but through making available what had been difficult for readers to otherwise obtain. And part of this started out with their quotes, extensive quotes, which despite the underlining and the full caps and all of that, those were accurate quotes. But then they also have published complete documents that were not otherwise available. And so that has been an important contribution to Mormon historiography. They are former Mormons who've become evangelical Christians, and I don't agree with their point of view, but I have to give them credit where credit is due, and they have made many historical documents, in whole or in part, available to readers who would otherwise have either had no opportunity or very limited opportunity in getting access to them.
The recent book, Origins, by someone Palmer, do you know the book I'm talking about?
Yes.
What's your comment about that book?
I can't comment on Grant Palmer's insider's view of Mormon Origins because I haven't read it. And it's not because I've singled him out not to read. There are many wonderful books that I just have not read yet because I've been doing other things.
So we'll just get one more comment.
Okay. Does this work? Okay. I don't know where this occurs in your writing because I've read so much of your stuff, but one passage comes to mind where you talked about your research activities from earlier years where you had more or less free access to almost anything in the Salt Lake area that you needed to get. And then suddenly doors began to close. But you were able, with the research that you did during those years, to produce the bulk of those works that we all consider to be quite earth-shaking. Is that changing now? What's your perspective on
my view changing, or is the access changing?
Is the access changing? What's going on there?
Well, it's a mixed reality. It's not simply a mixed image, but it's a mixed reality. There are sources that are controversial that are available at the LDS archives. They have a computer catalog, which is really quite wonderful and easy, very user-friendly to use. But the fact is that many sources that 35 years ago were available to all scholars who walked in the door and asked for them if they had a legitimate research project that they could explain to the people in the church historian's office, many of those documents are simply not available to anybody now. And there are restriction notations. And some of those restriction notations are see staff member. Others say available only by permission of the director of the historical department, who is a general authority. And then some of them say permission only by access only by permission of the first presidency, which you know the answer to that question. So these things, without exception, these were all available on request 35 years ago. So there are things that are just simply unavailable, and that has not changed. However, there was a period in the mid-1980s, or in fact, 1985, when almost the doors were shut and soldered, welded, closed. And that occurred because of a requirement for researchers to sign a form that gave the right of prior publication review by a committee before anything could be published. And after about 5 years, they abandoned that requirement. And now the form that is required that you sign is similar to a form you would sign if you went to Yale or the Chicago Historical Society or any other, or ASU's Special Collections. It's a form that essentially protects the materials you're going to be looking at from destruction, and also requires you to conform to fair use according to congressional law. But this is standard in any archives. And so that has now opened up, and the archives at the LDS Church is now on basically on par with any other research institution, except that there are certain documents that at one time were available to anybody. I mean, when I was there as a graduate student, fresh out of the Army, I was sitting next at a table researching the diaries of Heber G. Grant, and I was sitting next to a non-Mormon who was doing a dissertation at Princeton University, and he was reading First Presidency files from 100 years ago. And all he had done was ask, do you have any First Presidency files? They said, oh, yes, we do. And they handed them to him. Well, that is not possible at this point. So it's a mixed bag.
So I would like to take the opportunity to thank and ask you to thank again, and thank you all for coming.